Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. Today's podcast is going to be focused around stock selection. It's going to be looking at tools available to investors that are building portfolios of individual stocks. We're going to be bringing in some case studies, and we're also going to be looking at how investors can interpret real world information. And to do that, we're very kindly joined today by Ed Croft, who is the founder and CEO of Stockopedia. Ed, very much welcome you back to the podcast.
Jonathan, thanks for having me back. It's great to be here.
So these are always really interesting conversations, Ed, because we go through the data that's available to investors, and we also look at how they can put this to work. And a little bit later on in the podcast, we're going to be touching on some real world scenarios and individual companies. But before we get started, please, would you be able to give us an introduction, first of all, to Stockopedia, as well as yourself, for those that may not be aware, please?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we're a research platform for private investors. We've, 10,000 paying subscribers. And I founded it with my friend and co-founder many moons ago now, basically to try and give a better and ad-free place which could provide significant value to private investors. You know, I'd been a wealth manager in the city, and I had always had access to kind of Bloomberg terminals and fantastic research. And when I became a private investor, I sort of realized that actually all that I had around me was, it was a lot of advertising. Also, you go on a lot of retail platforms and there's a lot of crypto pushed at people and these things. I mean, back then it was other things, but a lot of leveraged products and things which are kind of not really appropriate. And there was also sort of an assumption that private investors would sort of be given share tips and would be, kind of consume these things. And often we'd be guided into very high risk kind of securities and things. And we realized that if you use the data in a way that, a good hedge fund or systematic equity investing process would, and provide scores and sensible, it's a sort of numeric guidance into the shares which are statistically more likely to outperform, you could really help private investors nudge themselves towards better investment outcomes. And I'm very, very pleased to say that's very much what we have done since we started. And it's a fantastic place. We've got brilliant subscriber community who engage every day, always hustling out and finding the very best investments in the market. And, our rankings and data and platform and portfolio trackers really help everybody do much better. So that's kind of a bit of the background. And, it all kind of came for me from the motivation actually was to sort of sort my own investing out, because even though I, was a bright spark and had great education and, great city background, I made a bunch of mistakes in the financial crisis, which I didn't want to happen again. So anyway, long story short, putting the rigor in place so that you are, able to invest in a more rules-based fashion and you can get much, much more consistent results.
So as you alluded to there, this conversation is going to be focused around the process and the investment process and employing rules to their stock selection. But I think a good place to start would be to actually look at a potential real world situation, so we can really frame the rest of the conversation in what investors are going to be doing with their own portfolios. So, and I think this is actually going to be quite a good way to frame stock ranks as well. So, as part of this answer, please do provide, some more information here. But, there's going to be scenarios where investors are looking at two companies. There's going to be one company that's been a real winner. It's been on a brilliant run. It's probably a darling of the stock market for the last 10 years. There's one company like that, and they're considering that against a company which has only just recently started to make positive sounds. So, one that, may have a positive update, may see an uptick in earnings. Investors then have the decision of picking one of these. And if we look at the hypothetical situation of they have a choice of holding one of these stocks for a year, from your research, from the data that you have, which one would you say makes the most money on a historical basis?
Yeah, I mean, that is really kind of the basis of, of this conversation is we've done a big study on exactly this. But I think the kind of the lead into this is to answer that, I think, puzzle as you framed it. I think the instinct would be, let's say if you have a kind of incumbent quality stock that, you know, has been there for a while and always like looking the same, to something which has just sort of, you know, jumped into the same sort of frame. The data pretty categorically says that you shouldn't buy the proven one. And that's a little bit controversial in a way, but it says you should actually look at the one that's just changed. And there's bags of research, or that we've done, but also historically, that aligns with what we've done. And maybe in this conversation we'll talk a little bit about that. But essentially, the market kind of adjusts quite gradually and too slowly in a way to new information and to something that's significantly changed. We can talk a little bit about some of the mechanics of this. But if you're a stock picker and you're looking for companies that may outperform over a kind of 12-month basis, it's that something new that really often drives a significant change in rating of a share. And that's what's particularly interesting for this study we've done. You know, maybe I should sort of explain how this works a little bit, because I think one of the ways to sort of measure this is to have a measure of how good a stock might be. And that's basically the basis of our study, because we do actually score every company in the market out of 100 with 100 best. And we look at their quality, profitability, their value or cheapness, and the momentum, which is whether the shares are and sentiment is improving. And 100 we score as best, and we have a whole quantitative process to do this. We call this the stock rank. And essentially, shares that are in the top cohort of that, 90 to 100, tend to outperform on average. And we've got, you know, 13 years of history, all public, about, and the shares that score the lowest tend to underperform. And that's been well known. And we've, you know, we've known that, and subscribers know that. And that's one of the kind of key core value propositions of our service. But I think the interesting thing is, what happens if a share suddenly moves into being a higher quality, good value, and stronger sort of trend at all at once? And that often happens because of some sort of event or something that makes that score sort of jump. Now, you don't need to actually even sort of know what the stock ranks are. And maybe later we can talk about kind of actually what's going on here. But that is essentially the answer, is if there's something new, there's new results, it's in the news, something's happened, or there's a big re-rating from the brokers, that significant change actually can be a really key pivotal moment that means the next 12-month returns are significantly higher. And we found there's about a kind of a 5.5% difference in performance of those new sort of, we call them jumpers.
We're going to speak about now, you know, what actually is a jumper. But I mean, one thing that I'd noticed, which is particularly interesting about the stock ranks, is it does challenge conventional thinking in investing, where you mentioned there, it looks at, you know, value, momentum, growth. You know, a lot of investors may lean towards either one of those. You know, some investors may be looking at companies with particularly low PE ratios, for example, or price to book, and consider themselves a value investor. Others may be looking at companies which are seeing big earnings growth and consider themselves, of course, a growth investor. StockRank seems to bring all of these together. And that takes me on to the point that you mentioned about that the jumpers. What are the key driving factors to a jump in this score, considering it takes in lots of different factors?
I mean, generally, the biggest impact is always going to be new financial results. So if financial statements suddenly change, you're going to get new balance sheet items and income statement items. So the profit, you know, profitability might have changed. Maybe the leverage has gone down. And, you know, when you get a whole suite due to interim results at the half year mark, or annual results at the end of year, that's normally one of the biggest inputs. But it also can jump because sometimes there could be a significant revision in broker estimates, which can also impact, you know, if guidance is upgraded and things like that. But normally it's financial statements, because that will impact the quality measures, so the profitability and the leverage and so on, as I said. But it also can impact the valuation ratios. So if it's suddenly much more profitable, the P ratio might be much lower. And when these things come through, it's normally after the news has hit the wires and however long it takes to process the data. But that is normally kind of a very pivotal moment. And we've seen, you know, sometimes you can see extraordinary changes in the profile of a company, which the market then becomes very slow to respond to. And what is interesting is often the share price does jump on the day good news is announced, but even then it can be slow to respond. And that slowness of responding, we've seen some pretty significant numbers in terms of annualized returns across the cohorts of stocks that do this.
Just one question that I had that just jumped to mind. And, you know, this is from my days as a broker and using technical analysis and, you know, that notion of having lagging and leading indicators. A stock rank movement, what's the relationship between a stock rank jumping and the share price moving? Is it a leading or a lagging? What's the relationship?
Well, it's there? Quite a subtle one, actually. I mean, I would say because there's both a value component and a trend component. So the irony here is that shares get cheap when the share price goes down or the fundamentals improve. But then the momentum actually increases when the share price is going up. And actually the very, very, very best type of share and the one that tend to rank the best are those that are both cheap, but also with rising share prices. So actually that's a sweet spot. You actually want to find shares that are actually very, very cheap and ignored, but where the share price has been moving very positively for the last year. And actually you'd be surprised that those are the very, very best performing types of shares in the market. Because they are often have been significantly neglected, and maybe the share price has been going down for multiple years, but in the last 12 months it starts moving upwards. And I think that's where, you know, you find that this slow adjustment to new information happens that leads to such outstanding future returns. Because often what happens in these cases is that companies will tell you with their words first. So we've done a lot of work on, you know, analyzing the trading statements and language used in results statements. And companies often will say things like, we are trading materially ahead of expectations or significantly ahead of expectations. Or they will say, we are upgrading guidance. And that happens in the words first, often in trading statements, before it hits the real numbers in the results. And even then, it will only after that will get into our ranks. And then, what we find is that in spite of that, the ranks, even though they're kind of third down the line from words to numbers to the rank, there's still this extraordinary uplift. So I think all of this is kind of public information. I think many people think that stock markets are efficient and, you know, you hear a huge amount of, you know, people saying out there, oh, you can't beat the market, just chuck it all in an index fund. And while for the majority of investors, an index fund is probably the most appropriate thing, if you're very interested in equity market investing, you can significantly beat the market with this sort of rigorous, more data-driven approach, which is a hell of a lot easier than trying to be kind of masterful stock picker. And I take all my signals from the actual objective data in the market, and it works. It works brilliantly well. So anyway, that's the interesting thing. So, I know you asked about the technical and fundamental analysis. The great thing about stock ranks is it actually incorporates fundamentals and technicals into a simplified measure. But the irony is, as I said, value and momentum kind of zig and zag at the same time, but the very best shares are the cheap shares that are actually on the move.
Indeed. So as you say, this is something you've been putting into practice yourself with your own investing for some time, and of course made it an official service product as such with Stockopedia. What was the drive to actually do that? And I really want to get into the stats here. You know, what did you find in terms of the numbers? And you know, when you put that in place, what have you found? What are the actual stats, the headline stats that you have around the stock?
Because we've done a lot of work in the past, and because, you know, we're this community site, we have all of our, you know, many, many people and great, super high engagement on webinars and on everything we write. And we've always sort of published lots of sort of ways to effectively try and improve your returns with portfolio strategies, model portfolio strategies and more. But I think one thing that always comes up is because we publish these ranks on every stock in the market. And sometimes people will see, because we've got it charted, and be like, oh, there's a big jump in this rank. I think, you know, someone actually asked me the actual question, if there's a big jump in the stock rank, does that mean it's better than a stock that's already got a rank? Is there new information? And does that have an edge? And to be honest, I had, you know, never studied it. We've done a lot of studies. We publish daily how the rankings actually perform. And we, you know, a couple of years ago, we did a good 171 page ebook on the rankings with loads and loads and loads of studies. But we hadn't actually looked at whether the rank jumping had ever had any edge. And so essentially what we found in this study we just done is that when a company's rank leapt, by 10 to 20 points and landed in the top 10% score of the market. The average one-year return was 15.9% on a one-year holding period basis, whereas for companies that were already in that cohort, the average was 10.7%. So there was a 5.2% difference between in one-year return of the new arrivals versus the resident incumbents, as it were. So in other words, there is quite a significant edge. And I think that's the motivation, was to answer that question. And of course, but you know, it's nothing is ever as straightforward as that. You know, they say there's lies, damn lies, and statistics. And the truth is in the nuance of the numbers, which maybe we'll go into a little bit. But in essence, that's the sort of headline. But, you know, averages need to be slightly unpicked for the, you know, the nuances within them.
We've covered the process there, but what I'd like to speak about now is more the why it works in practice. And I think this goes into, you know, market psychology, investor psychology. You would think, and you touched on efficient markets, that as soon as this news comes out, that, you know, it's fully priced in, and, you know, if they get further updates, that's priced in. It doesn't leave that opportunity, because as soon as that comes out, you'd think you get to a price that the market's fairly valuing a particular stock. But of course, we know that isn't what actually happens in real life, and that's the opportunity for investors. So, you know, looking at, you know, the big mechanic behind this, why is the market, in your perspective, from where you're sitting, why is the market slow to pick up on these improving stories in stocks?
This is actually one of the biggest anomalies. They actually call it an anomaly in the academic research. And it's been an anomaly that's gone on for 40 years. And they actually call it the post-earnings announcement drift, or if you use the letters for an acronym, PEAD. And I think there was a couple of guys called Ball and Brown who first discovered this in 1968. And there have been, I mean, there must have been 50, 60, 100 research papers actually about this. And essentially, when a company delivers an earnings surprise, in other words, they surprise the market with positive results, earnings above expectations, the share price often jumps. It, in fact, normally does. You know, we all know if there's a profit warning, the shares slump 25%. It's a nightmare. And if a company has good news, it jumps. But interestingly enough, the share price doesn't jump to the right level. It actually continues drifting in the same direction, either up if it's good news or down if it's bad news, which is why you should never buy after a profit warning. And it's that underreaction that's always seen as an anomaly. And it's really, really enduring. And it's even more enduring in small companies. And I think there's a whole range of psychological reasons why. And I think, you know, you imagine if you were someone looking to buy that share and you didn't buy it before that bit of news, suddenly the share price jumps 10% or 20%. And you're like, oh, I've missed it. And you don't buy it. So there is actually too little buying on the news, because a lot of people who would be buying actually stopped buying. And a lot of people who held it were like, oh, I'm never going to get a better price than this. So they sell. And people are often anchored on the valuation as it was before. And therefore, there is a slow reaction due to that anchoring and slow adjustment that people have to the new norm. And eventually they realize the prices are never coming down and they kind of will buy it. Or they spend the time and the slow diffusion of that news and information comes through, and gradually everyone starts realizing, oh, crikey, there's something is really positive going on here. So, and that slow diffusion and that anchoring and adjustment, it happens a lot more in smaller companies than it does in large companies, because large companies have often got 40 analysts covering them, and they're all, the market gets much more efficient in large caps. But in small companies where private investors got the edge, this is a really, really enduring thing. So anyway, that's the essence of it. I'm always amazed it continues and continues and continues. And we've seen no disappearance in this edge in, you know, the quality, value, and momentum and these principles over the last, you know, 13 years since we've been publishing the ranks. I'm honestly baffled at how this doesn't get arbitraged away in the market. And that's quite exciting for small cap investors, I think.
Just touching on their really interesting point that you make, that it tends to work better with smaller companies. But of course, different people have different perceptions of smaller companies, and smaller companies themselves are very different. There's lots of different subsectors of smaller companies. So when you look at that, where does it tend to work best within the smaller companies space. What are the key characteristics and attributes of these companies that tend to respond well to stock ranks and tend to perform well based on the ranking?
We found that we tend to call small caps, you've got to draw a line somewhere. So we call it under 350 million market cap. And generally that sort of aligns with where the FTSE 250 starts. That's the sort of the mid-cap index in the UK. So we kind of think of small caps below 350 million and micro caps below 50 million. The problem with small caps and micro caps is you have worse liquidity down there. So wider spreads. Often if you buy a share, you're going to be several percent out on your when you open it. And a lot of people don't like that. In bad markets, liquidity can dry up. So there is risk. But it's much, much, much stronger in smaller and smaller companies. So especially amongst 50 million or less market cap, you see much, much, much higher performance. But hidden within those numbers, there is quite a lot of skew because you get, maybe we'll go into later some of the kind of examples, but you have some companies that do hundreds of percent and then many that don't. And that's the thing. But yes, the edge is where people aren't looking and where institutions aren't really following them. And they can't buy in enough size to really make a difference in their funds. And they have to acquire slowly. So that's the other one of the other powers in driving performance is that if a fund wants to accumulate a really good new story, they have to buy it through time, gradually, carefully. And that builds the pressure, upwards pressure on share prices.
You mentioned there we're going to look at real world scenarios in individual companies. I think that's a good place to pick that up, Ed, because it's going to tie together some of the key points that you just made there. So what does a company look like? Can you give any examples of a company that has been picked up by a high stock rank and then performed particularly well? Maybe one that people aren't aware of, maybe one of those that you could consider a little bit under the radar.
Yeah, I mean, I could give a few. I think, you know, there are lots and lots of these. And the ones that I've bought myself always spring to mind. And I can sort of give, you know, some of my best winners in the UK stock market might be, for example, U Group, you know, which has YU, is, you know, as in YU with an umlaut for some reason. And they're like energy and smart meter company. But that flashed, I think it was back in October 2022. And I didn't actually buy it until January 2023, which is annoying. Now I'm a bit more switched on to the moment things actually move. But from the moment of that stock rank jump, when it jumped 24%, points up to a 99 rank. At that point, it was a 34 million market cap. So very, very kind of small cap. And once it had completed its run, it actually ran 493%. So that's kind of an example. Another one that I bought was in the pandemic, October 2020, was Reach PLC, which used to be Trinity Mirror, owns all those kind of newspapers. And that jumped 21 to 90 and rocketed 338%. You know, they're kind of lesser known, but sort of show you smaller caps that can really, really move. And maybe one that people might know a bit more, which didn't quite make it to the 90 plus set, but obviously Rolls-Royce was, you know, is a large cap that performed extraordinarily well. And that had a very significant jump, actually. It was really in the doldrums for many, many years. And then suddenly all the financials changed. And I think it was Feb 23 or something like that. And it suddenly moved. It had been sort of floundering around on a kind of like 20, 25, 40, 50, and then suddenly jumped up to 80s and 90s. And it sort of 10-bagged after that. Now, of course, these are, I should probably give you some honest facts here. It's much more important to be honest. The averages I state are obviously skewed by some of the winners. So for example, you know, if you do have a share that does hundreds of percent, it's going to skew the average for all of them. And that's why it really is a basket effect. You know, what I actually tend to do when there's a jump, I will basically use it as a flag that something significant has changed. And I will use it as a trigger to do significant amount of research. And when that happens, that then becomes like it's like a flashpoint on a share. Let's say there's a share like a tiny company called Chromec last year that I bought some shares on when the rank jumped from 20 to like 99. And it had been a share I'd never looked at in, you know, 10 years because it had always been pre-revenue, unprofitable. I only buy profitable companies. And suddenly the rank suddenly jumped. And basically it flagged that if you looked, when I then looked at the financial statements and I looked at the underlying numbers, I knew something significant had changed and it proceeded to double after that. And it's come off quite a lot now, but it's still sort of 50% up. And, you know, and I think it's these sorts of things are just a signal, because there's such a range. If you look at Reach PLC, I mentioned before, that one moment I was lucky enough to own it, and it sort of quadrupled, but it triggered this jump 5 times in its history, and the 4 other times it was a loser. So, you know, I think we found that there was it's like a sort of 55%, you know, win rate. So it's not necessarily a guarantee that you're going to have a winner. What it means is that the big winners actually perform exceptionally well and go on these wonderful runs. And there's so many sort of cases of these. So I think that's one of the ways, I think you've got to either use this in 2 ways. You've got to go, right, it's a 20 stock portfolio effect, and you want to try and populate a portfolio with these fresh new candidates, or you use it as a trigger to go and do a heck of a lot more research on an individual name. And so from a stock picker perspective, it's quite a useful kind of motivator.
Yes, I mean, you mentioned their U Group. I remember, and it's probably about a similar time that you touched on, Ed, sort of back in 2022, 2023, we interviewed the CEO just after their earnings. And, you know, it was quite clear at that point in time that it was a very well-run business. The results at that point were fantastic. It had a very good capital structure as well, which was supportive of further growth. And of course, it went on and did very well. I think, and one of the things that you touched on there, is looking at stock ranks. What it suggests to me is, yes, it's a tool to help analyze individual companies, but it also a discovery tool as well, because, you know, people obviously saw over time what U Group was doing, and, you know, it became a real success story and became a very popular stock. If you just look at the chart and sit and see what it's done. But of course, if you're saying at that point in time, stock ranks was then flashing and saying that this is a company that's going in the right direction, that would have then been a tool for investors from an awareness perspective to actually know about those stocks. So that's quite interesting. But I mean, that naturally then brings me on to some of the larger cap companies. And we've obviously seen huge gains over the last 5 years in names such as Rolls-Royce. Does the stock ranks pick up companies like this? And, you know, of course, they've been on a tremendous rally, 10x, I think they've been on. So, you know, of course, that is by no means a small company. Even when it was down in the doldrums, it was, you know, you couldn't consider it a small company. So what's the balance there between picking up those sort of under the radar, very well valued ones that are set for a period of growth, and those ones which are larger companies, everybody knows, with very liquid, you know, how does it balance those out?
It's a good question. And we've done loads of these research studies. So ones we've done in the past, I did a one I greatly enjoyed putting together, which was looking at the top 10 multi-baggers of the last decade. And actually they did, I think on average, at the start of their runs, have a stock rank of like 85, which meant they were sort of ranked in the top 15% of the market. But generally they had higher quality ranks. So they tend to be profitable, because good, highly profitable companies tend to reinvest their earnings. I think one of the, if you take Games Workshop as an example, it didn't necessarily have, you know, a kind of a big jump, as we were saying. But what it did have is at the start, like if I track back to like 2017, which was when Games Workshop really took off, it actually had a 99 rank. So, but particularly driven by the fact it was very neglected. It was very undervalued. I remember back then, you know, very, very low P/E ratio, but it was super profitable and paying lots and lots of dividends. And then they just nailed the strategy. And actually the trigger, like I said before, because we did big case studies on this, and it's the same with U Group you're talking about, because I've looked at that a lot as well, and looked at their trading statements through time. And both Games Workshop and U Group, they had this catalogue of trading statements and results statements that literally said the words, significantly ahead of expectations, or materially ahead of expectations. And even though in Games Workshop there wasn't a jump, because it was already very high ranked, it was those points that actually found the takeoff point. If I go back to Jet2, which was called Dark Group back in like 2014, it was the same thing. And those are the magic words. When companies say trading statements, if you read the news, you don't have to be a subscriber to us at Stockopedia, you know, this is the point. It's like, if you are looking at the news and you are reading the tape, and you will see companies with trading statements who are basically saying, they will say, oh, we are in line with expectations, we're ahead of expectations, we're below expectations, and the dreaded word significantly below. But below or significantly below is often a, we call a profit warning. Whereas we found that companies that say they're significantly ahead, which are quite rare, like I think in the last few months, there's only been like half a dozen of them. And if they have also a positive market reaction, so you see a good jump in price, it's a huge, huge factor in defining a turning point in a company. And for Games Workshop, it was exactly that. They had a sequence of those in 2017 that was the marker. Same with Rolls-Royce. They actually, you can track back through the news statements, and they, I think they at least two or three times they said they were materially ahead of expectations. And you quite rarely see that in larger companies. One that I've seen, you know, actually I've invested in, Morgan Sindall through many years has done that. So I think like the marriage, and this has been the really core focus of our research recently, is the marriage of the data, the rankings showing you, you know, good quality, reasonably valued, good momentum. But the marriage of that with also the words that, that companies are using in their financial statements is really kind of a bit of a magic combination. So anyway, that's me. I went off on one there, but that's kind of the answer to the question.
No, that was really interesting. So I just want to move on now, Ed, and look at how people use it. And, you know, as you said at the beginning, you've got a very deep and engaged community, so I'm sure you get lots of feedback. So for listeners that maybe aren't subscribers already, how are you seeing subscribers to the tool using it? I'm sure they're not just going out and blindly buying any stock that has a high ranking. How does it fit into the actual process of selecting stocks for your subscribers?
Well, I think people do use them in two different ways. And, you know, I've run essentially a example portfolio I call the NAPS portfolio and no admin portfolio editorially. And that's, I forget the exact performance figures, but it's like been 15% annualized over 10 years. And that's a blind 20 stock portfolio, just picking the top two ranked of each sector across 10 sectors. And that's got some tremendous interest as a result, because it sort of shows if you back the averages, it's just a better index in a way, a better way to construct a portfolio than, you know, index investing tries to buy just like the largest companies. And, you know, surprise, surprise, it's done well in America because there's a lot of monopoly businesses in America and that, you know, sort of reinforced structurally. But in the UK, it's been a terrible way to run a portfolio. And whereas this is a much, much more kind of, you know, robust process. Who wouldn't want their portfolio filled with profitable, undervalued, positive sentiment companies? You know, that's what the ranks do. But of course, people also, we've got, you know, we play host to our subscribers, many of the best stock pickers in Britain. And I think the first thing I know that people do, because they tell me, is they just, first thing they do if they hear of a share is they just eyeball the ranks, because it gives them a very quick litmus test of whether, you know, of what kind of profile of a company it is. You can very quickly spot when you learn to read it, you know, what's the growth profile, what's a turnaround profile, what's, you know, you know what you're dealing with very quickly. And being able to see very quickly if it's, you know, got no profits and everything else, it's in a number is a huge time saver. So, but then, you know, people will go and do their own research and make their own decisions. So you can use it in two different ways, a more systematic rules-based portfolio-driven way, or as a kind of a research accelerator on an individual by individual share basis.
So, of course, you know, it sounds like stock ranks are very helpful for helping people to identify opportunities and of course, you know, add them to their portfolio. But one of the most difficult things, certainly something that I struggle with myself, is knowing when to sell.
Mm.
How do you help investors do that?
Well, you know, selling is kind of one of the hardest things in investing, really. And because most people kind of just sort of do it on gut instinct, you know, and I think people should just be rules-based in their selling process and actually pre-commit to the way they're going to do it. And the truth is that the best and optimal holding period for higher ranked shares is about a year. And we find that, you know, that works as a sweet spot. And, you know, generally you're going to find a lot of the uplift in valuation and capture that momentum or valuation uplift over the course of 12 months. And then if it's still looking great, you hang on to it. But if it's not, you find other candidates. And that's part of the great fun of investing is, you know, finding the new candidate shares. But then also, so you could just use a calendar. But we actually found in this study that we did around these stocks that jump, We actually found it was more optimal if you were buying the kind of shares that jumped 90 plus and then you sold when they dropped below an 80 rank. So that actually outperformed just the calendar basis of a holding period on average, because it actually meant that you actually held some of the big winners longer, and you know, you got the one you might have sold the ones which you know didn't hold up faster. So it kind of reinforced that kind of run your winners and cut your losers early kind of mindset, which a calendar based approach can't help with. But those two approaches are very robust in my opinion.
So of course, Ed, no system's perfect. And, you know, we spoke about, you know, some great returns there. But of course, there's going to be a few failures along the way. What are the biggest constraints that you've seen from this system? Of course, you use it yourself and have done for many years. What are the things that people should look out for when using the system?
So, you know, portfolios that I run on this have done very, very well over the long term. And, you know, I will more sort of talk about my model portfolios. It's all public and out in the open and everything else, sort of like public track record and so on. And of course, when you look at it and you kind of go, oh, wow, it's, you know, done 450% before dividends over the 11 years that it's been public, it looks really amazing. But actually within that, you know, almost 4.5 out of 10 shares are losers. And actually the outperformance is driven by the skew in the big winners. And I think that's the case in all equity investing. There's an old saying by Peter Lynch, who was a great fund manager. And he said that in this game, he was the greatest like Fidelity fund manager. He ran the Magellan Fund and he was, you know, he's brilliant. He's got the wonderful books and an amazing man. And he said, in this game, if you can find 6 out of 10 winners, you're really good. And actually, it's not really so much about the number of times you're right on whether a share rises or not. It's about how right you are in, you know, when you are right. And that's kind of what I've been saying all along, is that there are some shares that really, really do go on and run and run. But, you know, so the truth is there are lots and lots of losers. And one has to expect that in any investing strategy that you take in the market. So I think that is really kind of the key thing here. And in the study that we did, there are lots and lots and lots of bad performers. We kept in our study all of the companies that actually did delisted or went bust, and you know, kept those in the study statistics. So I obviously tend to sort of focus on the winners, but it's important to kind of recognize that, you know, there are those which you might buy which go really, really wrong. And I mean, I remember one share which had a 99 rank called, it was DX, I think it was called DX Group. And I think that was a delivery company, I forget. And it actually fell 60% one day. So, you know, you never, in investing, this is just par for the course. And I think people need to go into, if they are thinking about getting into individual share investing, you've got to go in with your eyes wide open. I think there's a lot of bad misinformation out there, which is that people should sort of go and just buy, you know, just own a few eggs and watch that basket. And I think it's really poor advice generally. But, and in fact, in all my kind of back tests, I tend to find the sweet spot tends to have more shares in it, because you're more likely to own a big, big winner if you've got more in your portfolio. And if you find one share that does, you know, 200% in a year, that makes your year, it makes actually several years, because you're always going to have those that fall 50% or 60% or, you know, or more. So it's that upside skew you've got to capture. So always have enough shares in your portfolio to make sure you capture them.
Key message there, diversification and let your winners run. You know, getting 6 out of 10 doesn't seem that good, but as long as you're controlling the downside and making sure that the upside on those winners.
Yeah. People focus on trying to be right. You know, trying to get to like 8 out of 10 times right. The problem is people who are 8 out of 10 times right, often the ones that you're wrong on are so, so bad that it outweighs all of the ones that were right. You're honestly, the best investors I know don't have a win rate of more than, you know, 55-60%, because they just win so, so much on the picks that are really, really right. Pretty par for the course.
To wrap it all up today, Ed, been a really fascinating conversation. Where do people learn more? If people want to know a little bit more about Stockopedia and StockRanks, what's the best way for them to do that?
I think we're also doing a webinar on this topic, a lot more kind of visual information, which people might, you know, if they're listening to, maybe before or catch up, but we'll have lots of slides and other resources as well. But also, like, just go to www.stockopedia.com and, you know, take a, we've got completely free trial, there's no commitment. You know, you can cancel and you can have 2 weeks completely free, check it all out. You'll see all the kind of shares that have recently moved their rankings on the homepage. And you'll see people talking about these ideas all the time in our discussion areas and where we kind of publish editorial and we've got very engaged communities. So it's really kind of the place to, it's a wonderful environment for stock market investors. And, you know, that's the place to go.
Indeed. And as you said, Ed, a note to listeners, do check out the description to this podcast because there'll be a link through to the upcoming webinar. And if you're listening to this after the webinar, there'll also be a link in there through to the resources that Ed kindly outlined there. So do check out the notes to this podcast for further information. Ed, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Brilliant. Great fun. Thanks for having me.
And thank you very much to everyone for listening. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember all investment involves risk.